Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Trust is not a word that's used often in Iraq. It just doesn't seem to apply to the relations between all the different peoples, the races and religions that live under Saddam Hussein. There are Kurds who've spent as much time fighting each other as they have Baghdad. There are the Shia in the south, the Christians, the Assyrians. And the only thing these groups have shared is the years they've spent living under the eyes of the secret police and the control of the Ba'ath Party. So is that common ground enough to build a government on? Kanan Makiya thinks it is. And so he is hard at work, both advising the State Department on what democracy might look like, as well as soothing the squabbling between opposition groups who are due to meet in Belgium later this month. Neither job's proving to be very easy. News reports say some of the players may boycott the meeting, displeased with their share of the pie even before there's a pie to divide. Others are questioning the U.S. government's commitment to a long-term engagement in Iraq. Connection listeners, how important is it to know how Iraq might be ruled after Saddam Hussein? Can a new plan for democracy be devised, drawn up on a table, perhaps even imposed? Our number is 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Our guest today is Kanan Makiya. He's professor of Middle East Studies at Brandeis. He directs the Iraq Research and Documentation Project at Harvard. And for the last 3 months, he's been working with the State Department to devise a plan for democracy in Iraq after the removal of Saddam Hussein. He joins us from a studio in London. Hello.
Good morning, Dick.
Mr. Makiya, you're in London right now, I gather, in part to try and make this conference of dissidents actually happen. Is that right?
That is correct.
What are your chances?
They're looking good at the moment. If I might make one small comment, if you will allow me,
sure.
Dick, it's not so much a fight over a share of the pie. There are deep, deep existential questions at stake here. The future of the country is truly up for grabs in a way that very, very few countries in the world ever experience. So there are very genuine differences. I mean, the Kurds are sitting in a situation where they have a long border with Iran and another long border with Turkey. They have groups like the PKK and Ansar al-Islam, which are Qaeda-like groups. And every day that passes, two or three people get killed in one incident or another. They worry. They have forged alliances, say, with the Islamic Republic in Iran and have a tense and uneasy relationship with Turkey. And on the other hand, these constrain them. So then you have Democrats, independents, pushing hard to sort of turn this opportunity in a direction that is, you know, a revolutionary transformation, let's say, for the country and for the region. You have other groups that are derived originally from the Ba'ath Party, that is, they split from the Ba'ath Party, that don't want as revolutionary a transformation, as dramatic a transformation as, say, some of us do. So these are, I mean, understandable, perfectly real differences that are bound to emerge in a complex situation like that of the Iraqi one at this moment in time. And the fight is
It sounds like such a mess as to be, you know, that it's clear to me why those people are reluctant even at this point to sit around the same table.
Well, the issue at stake in the conference is not about sitting around the same table. It's about who attends the conference, and it's about the agenda of the conference.
Right.
Crucial, I mean, if you want, I can go into detail on either one of those.
I guess what I need you to explain for us is why it is you have the confidence that whatever issue divides these groups now, whether or not it's control over this city and the oil plants that and the oil, you know, refineries that are there, or whether or not it's whether they choose to share the same table, why is it that you're optimistic this and these difficulties can be overcome?
Because deep down, the Iraqi opposition represents a truly new phenomenon In Arab politics, in Middle Eastern politics. Mm-hmm. There are several dramatically new ideas which have taken root amongst the disparate number of groups that have various other differences with them, which suggests that there is something in the making here that can be moved in a very new direction. Let me give you an example. Take, for instance, the issue of federalism. The one thing all Iraqi opposition groups have in common is a commitment to a restructuring of the state of Iraq into a federal shape of one kind or another. This was an issue that was put on the table by the Kurds back in 1992 during their elections, was immediately picked up by the Iraqi National Congress. In fact, they were involved in the initial proposal in the Kurdish parliament. And it has since become common currency. Every single group that is today differing with one another over all sorts of issues agrees on something that is completely foreign to the region. They want a new Iraq that is somehow or another federally structured. There's differences of opinion over what that means, over how to, what content to give to that word.
Can I just interrupt you for a minute? Just a clarification here, because isn't it equally possible that when it gets down to dividing up the country into a federal state,
yes,
that the Kurds might say to themselves, finally, our opportunity for Kurdistan, that the Shia in the south might say, you know, we have a lot more in common with our Iranian brethren to the east than we do with the Sunnis to the north, and that Iraq as we know it today won't survive.
But, Dick, the position of every Arab Iraqi I know of, or the overwhelming majority of them that I work with daily, is that if the Kurds want to separate, first, no Iraqi will ever fight over the issue of a forced unity. It doesn't happen. Federalism is a Kurdish demand, as I put it to you earlier.
Right.
It is a Kurdish argument. It's a Kurdish novelty that has been injected and successfully accomplished. Iraqis are working with that reality. And there will be no forced keeping of Kurds inside. It's the Kurds who want a federally structured Iraq.
So the other sort of extreme point of view that Iraq after Saddam Hussein will look like Yugoslavia after Marshal Tito, with everybody splintering and trying to grab their piece of land or their claim to the country, you don't think that's a possibility?
I think many terrible things are a possibility, but not that.
And do you think that by getting the different groups, and I guess I mean all of them because that's part of the issue, around a table, even while Saddam Hussein is in power, that the conversation about what comes next is one where people are actually ready to say, okay, we'll listen?
Yes. There is real discussions going on here. I've met with every single one of the people of the parties of the six. Intense meetings going on all the time. There is now a growing consensus that the document you referred to in your introduction, that it's called the Transition to Democracy,
right,
document that was actually not myself alone. It was 32 different Iraqis who put together. That document, which is almost near completion, will be the working document of the conference. And that was a major demand, position. If that gets firmed up, that's why I'm here, to argue that that document should be the fundamental basis, the position paper, if you like, that gets discussed, amended, changed, whatever happens to it at the conference, but that document should be the basis of it, and it looks like it's going to happen.
Professor McKee, I should clear something up here. The work that you're doing to make the conference happen, do you do this as an employee or an agent of the State Department in the United States? Who are you working for here?
Absolutely not. I had to take leave from my university to do this. They very kindly did so and allowed me that. And at the moment, I am technically unemployed. Lecture fees and articles is all that keeps me going. But absolutely not. I do not receive, nor does any single other Iraqi as part of the Future of Iraq project, as it's called, receive anything whatsoever. The State Department is a facilitator. It has made this happen. It is not paying anybody.
I want to ask you to expand a little bit on something that you've said before, and that is that at one level, Iraqi citizens would welcome a war. You need to be a little more specific for me.
Yes. Well, another way of putting it is, the overwhelming majority of Iraqis will treat an American army, certainly in the first few months, as liberators. They will shower them with flowers and candy and sweets and so on. There's just no doubt about it. Anybody who even suggests there is just doesn't know what he's talking about. But How long will it last is the question that is a genuine question that is on everybody's mind. Let me put it to you also, Dick, a bit differently. Mm-hmm. Let's go back for a second to 1991. It's relevant here. To show you that, again, it touches a point about this change in sensibility, this fundamentally different quality that an Iraqi consciousness has from the rest of what we normally think of as Middle Eastern politics. When the Gulf War was being waged, while the bombing was still going on and under the most intensive aerial bombardment that any population had ever experienced, I think, since World War II, that is intense, maybe not spread out in Vietnam. It was probably greater in amount, but spread out over a longer period of time. Over those 6 weeks, the overwhelming majority of Iraqis rose up against their own regime and called upon these people, these allies who had been bombing them, to help finish the job. They asked of them to finish it up. They actually took over 2/3 of the governance of the city. The regime was on the brink, on the edge of falling. I mean, the greatest historical mistake that the United States made was not finishing that war. So here you have a phenomenon that has never happened in Arab politics before. An Arab Muslim population calling upon a largely Western coalition that has ripped the country to pieces, torn the infrastructure to shreds, to finish the job, to go on into Baghdad. Now, that is the sensibility that is still at work. When they were let down back in 1991, of course, Iraqis felt terribly despondent, and they blamed the United States. They figured, incorrectly as it turns out, but you can understand it from their point of view, that 500,000 American soldiers had come halfway across the world to push Saddam out of Kuwait. And therefore, if he was still in power, it must be, they concluded, because the United States wanted him to stay in power.
One of the existing shrines in Baghdad today is that bunker that was blown up in 1991. And I was inside that bunker beginning of last year and shown where all the women and children were killed. And I guess what I'm wondering when you say that people will welcome the kind of attack is, what if something like that goes horribly wrong in the south, in Basra, in Kirkuk, in Sulaymaniyah, in the north? Isn't that support for a U.S. invasion fairly fragile if there's a lot of bloodshed on the way to Baghdad?
The uprising followed that bunker incident. What Iraqis are saying is that they are willing to pay the price of this war. Nobody wants war, but there are times when it is necessary. And Iraqis are saying, we are willing to pay this price. Now, one should wage this war because they say that. But unfortunately, in the type of discussion that's gone on in the anti-war movement, in between those who are for or against this war in the West, it's largely been those who are for it because of these weapons of mass destruction, which are about what they will do to us in the West, versus those who are against it because of American imperial hegemony, unilateral action, sort of cowboy operating in the world type of attitude, abstractions of one kind or another. Both sides leave out the people who are most directly affected, namely Iraqis. Notice something here. Iraqis turned against the United States. Unlike the rest of the whole Arab world is against this, right? They're against it. Why? Because they don't want the United States involved in the region. Iraqis are upset with the United States for not being involved.
I'm going to stop you there. We have to take a short break. We'll continue the conversation about the motivation for an attack on Iraq and the perspective of the Iraqi citizens. Connection listeners, we're at 1-800-423-8255. Kanan Makia trained as an architect. He's now part of the plan to help redesign democracy for Iraq after Saddam Hussein. Can it work? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from National Public Radio. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Connection listeners, the chance or the possibility or the likelihood of war in Iraq is still up in the air as weapons inspectors get ready to do their inspection. In fact, if you look at the timeline laid out by the United Nations, Iraqi President Saddam Hussein has still not given permission for the weapons inspectors to come in, but assuming they do that, it could be some considerable time before there is an attack on Iraq, if in fact one happens. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour we're talking with Kanan Makia about what would come after a war. Kanan is a writer, an architect. He wrote a book called Republic of Fear in the mid-80s under the pseudonym Samir al-Khalil. He wrote Cruelty and Silence in 1993. That was after he had access to northern Iraq and some of the documents outlining Saddam Hussein's brutality against the Kurds and material that he got from the Arab intelligentsia allowed him to pull that book together. He's now a coordinator for one of the coordinators for the State Department's Future of Iraq project for the past 3 months, working with some 30 other Iraqi dissidents to try and pull together a plan for democracy in a post-Saddam Hussein Iraq. And Mr. McKee, I should get you to pick up just where you were leaving off before the break about what it is that would motivate an attack on Iraq. For at the same time as you imagine people showering the American soldiers with sweets and flowers, if you go back through the recent speeches of President George Bush, this is all about protecting the United States from Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. In a way, it has more to do with the U.S. looking out for its own interests rather than looking out for the interests of ordinary Iraqis.
True, but only until recently. Think of the September 12th speech in the United Nations. Iraqis were absolutely ecstatic over that speech. It mentioned them over and over again. It mentioned Resolution 688. It talked about the suffering they'd gone through. For the first time, the president put them at the center of his argument. And also, let me add, I can recall Condoleezza Rice in a very important interview she gave to Financial Times, speaking of the reconstruction of Iraq, of the long-term commitment to it, of nation building, of how democracy need not stop at the edge of the Muslim world, and
okay,
so on.
Okay, but this is part of your work to keep that focus on
exactly.
The Iraqi people rather than off on into the protection for weapons of mass destruction, isn't it?
That's the be-all and end-all of what I'm doing.
Now, in part of the report that we were talking about earlier, I'm going to read a little bit here. It says that the government of the United States, further to a treaty with a new, duly constituted Iraqi government, agrees to keep a military presence inside Iraq whose purpose is to guarantee the territorial integrity of Iraq for a period measured in years, not months.
I have no idea how you got hold of that report, because it's still not been released. Where it's a draft.
Extremely good researchers here at The Connection. But I mean, the part that I wanted to talk about.
You're not supposed to have it. I certainly had nothing to do with it. So,
the part that I wanted to ask you about is the idea that there's a need for the United States to make a commitment in years, not months, to helping enforce the territorial integrity of Iraq. Because
I
know that colleagues of yours in Boston and Cambridge would roll their eyes at the notion that the United States could ever be held to a commitment that would last in terms of years, not months. There are already people saying that Afghanistan's being forgotten, Bosnia's already off the map.
True. Academic colleagues, I might add,
yes,
not
indeed.
Iraqi colleagues, who would roll their eyes.
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean.
Yes, but let me say the following. Firstly, Iraq is not Afghanistan, and from meetings I've had with very senior American officials, it seems that point is understood. This is a country that's rich enough, that has the human resources and the financial resources to pull it off. It's a country that has the intelligentsia, the middle class, the technocratic skills to do it. So, moreover, it's a country to which the United States is in some way morally committed after the last 1991 Gulf War, after the United States involved itself back then. There's a sense in which, if you think of the last 12 years of Arab politics dominated by this kind of dance between the Saddam Hussein and the inspectors in the United States in the larger sense, there is an involvement here, history. It's a contingent set of factors that make of Iraq something that I don't think applies to other countries. It doesn't apply to Syria, an equally nasty regime, or it doesn't apply to many of Saudi Arabia, which is a totally different set of relations with the United States. In Iraq, over 12 years, United States and the people of the United States and the people of Iraq have, through their governments, built up a complex, very complex now, a knitted together relationship, which in which I think there is an element of both. There's a moral commitment here and a political argument for it, an excellent political argument for it. This is the place to start if you're thinking of the region as a whole. American foreign policy in this part of the world has been, in recent years, a series of failures. Oslo has failed. A relationship with autocratic, repressive regimes of one sort or another, including Saddam Hussein himself in the 80s, that policy has come apart. The Saudi connection, which was such a pillar of American foreign policy, is increasingly estranged, to put it mildly. There is a close an umbilical connection between September 11th and that policy. We could talk about that. All of the way out of all of that, I put it to you, given the contingent set of circumstances involving the United States and Iraq, lies through Iraq.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Greensboro, North Carolina. Kwejo's on the line. Hi, Kwejo.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. I enjoyed the discussion so far. I want to ask two questions. The first one is the gentleman on the interview that you're interviewing with now, I want to ask him, will he be very, very much satisfied if Saddam Hussein allows the inspectors in and they go there and do the inspection and find out that there is nothing there and therefore everything is resolved amicably? Or is he going to be very disappointed because his wishes and desires are that Saddam Hussein be overthrown and their interest, that is, those of them who call themselves exiles, interest is served by them coming into power?
Kanan.
Let me see. I'm not in the slightest bit interested in power. I have nothing to do with it. I will always be an academic or writer of one kind or another. I'm not in this for any political gain. I'm interested in programmatic issues and not in political sort of posts down the line. There simply is no question but that he has these weapons. You know, the very idea that there's any doubt is strange. We know this not because Americans are telling this, but because increasing numbers of Iraqi defectors have been coming out over the years.
I think, though, Kanan, that what Kwejo's asking is that if the weapons inspection exercise takes place and it is resolved without an attack, that what is being described as a historic opportunity to change the politics of Iraq will be lost. And whether or not, Kwejo, help me here, but if I'm misrepresenting you, but I think that the question is actually not about your own aspirations, but about whether or not there'll be universal disappointment among exiles if there isn't a war.
Yeah, I don't think so, because I think the disarmament of Iraq, which that entails, will undo the regime, will completely and totally undo the regime, which is why I don't think it's going to happen.
So it could happen without war, but you're saying it's highly unlikely.
It's not happening. I don't think it will happen. And the regime is not going to willingly disarm itself. It's right. Just not going to do it. It's not. It's entirely contrary to its entire ethos and psychology. It's not going to happen.
Okay, Kwejo, back to you.
I mean, I'll grant you the theoretical possibility that if it is disarmed peacefully, purely as an abstract exercise, then the regime, my argument would be totally, completely transformed. It would be another kind of regime.
Right.
So, I'm all for it.
Okay, Kwejo, back to you.
Okay. Yeah, well, what I'm saying is that we are advocating, those of us who want the thing resolved peacefully. I mean, there is no question or doubt on our mind that Saddam Hussein may have those weapons, but our desire is that to see it resolved peacefully, because those of us who have come from third world countries have seen countless number of people who get it's a struggle for power, and those who don't get the power, they leave the country and go out and look for maybe come to the U.S. and begin to tell on the other government, so the country can be destabilized, so they can get into power, and this really sets the development of the countries back, because the ones who take power when the U.S. comes to aid them also begin to do the same things or even worse things. So, what are the guarantees that those people in exile, when if they should come into power, wouldn't do the same thing or even worse when they begin to see that, look, we are sitting on oil and we have power?
Okay,
you know?
Kwejo.
Look. a goodly majority of the Iraqi opposition is not sitting in exile. They have the Kurds, the Islamists, the Democrats were in there. There are people inside that are working closely at this very moment with the opposition. So that, I mean, it's not a bunch of, you know, London-based exiles. That image is completely false. But I grant you, if he were to peacefully give up power, hand over everything, and even disappear into the sunlight, I mean, that would be by far and away the best thing. I'd be very happy for it. But it ain't going to happen.
But what's the likelihood, if I take Quajo's point one step further, that regardless of who replaces Saddam Hussein in Iraq, the temptation to exploit the unbelievable wealth that exists under the ground isn't going to cause a whole new round of fighting inside the country?
The country has always had its resources nationally developed. I don't think there's any disagreement at the moment amongst the groups. There's nobody contemplating capturing individual oil wells and pumping and selling the oil separately. I mean, that notion's a pure fiction.
But the national development that's existed, Kanaan, I'm sure you'll agree with me, has existed because it's been done with such an iron fist.
That's right, but federalism does not mean that these resources are going to be geographically distributed. You know, we go into this in quite some depth in the document. Mm-hmm. The document says that these resources, like oil resources, are still national resources that should be allotted according to fixed formulas, a constitutionally prescribed formulas based on proportion of population and other criteria, so that each region receives what it has never received in the past, its fair share of the great big bonanza of oil revenues that represents an important chunk of Iraq's wealth and importance in the world.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Quajo, thanks for your call. We're going to Plainfield, Vermont now, and Michelle's on the line. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. I'm really glad you're having this conversation. I have one comment with a question and another question. My comment is, if what you say is correct, I think that the American people don't really know that. I mean, I think they're very lukewarm behind this effort, and everyone, including myself, thinks, oh, we'll go in, we won't know what to do afterwards, it'll be like Afghanistan or Bosnia, they'll all keep killing each other and nothing will happen and it'll just get worse. And the fact that all of this that you're talking about is not in the public discussion at all that I have ever heard before. So my first question is, how do you get that into the public discussion?
Michelle.
That's an excellent question, Michelle. You are right. It isn't. It ought to be. And if I might say that people like you could help bring it, and that's why I'm on this program. It ought to be at the discussion. What about the future? What about the non-military aspects of this? What is possible in this part of it? Well, you have here a situation, an opportunity. There is not you. I mean, we have an opportunity, both of us, Americans and Iraqis, a unique opportunity to do something right for a change. The fact that in the past it's so often been done wrong is not an argument for not pressing that it ought to be done right this time, because neither side is right. There is no morality to saying stay away from this, leave Saddam in there, perhaps all kinds of wishful thinking about him, allowing inspectors in and so on. The fact is, this is one of the worst regimes the world has seen since World War II. It is truly a unique experience. You have to have lived it to really know it. The rest of the Arab world doesn't know it because it isn't even able to imagine what it's like to live under this regime, what it has done to the social fabric of society. Now, there is a moral question here that Americans are asked to leave a country like that. It's an important country. It's a rich country. It's a key to that part of the world. It is imaginable to turn it around. It is doable, but it requires boldness. It requires vision. It requires everything but status quo conservative type of thinking about the region. Terrors and fears of all the terrible things the United States has done in the past. That's not the way to think. The way to think is what is possible, what is at heart so important, what the United States itself is all about, and how that can be deployed for the good of Arabs and Muslims.
Michelle, back to you.
Well, I totally am touched by your plea. The thing is, how would people ever find that out if they're not listening to The Connection? I mean, how would people know that there are these oppositions? I don't think you may not have the answer, but that seems to me that would change the climate, certainly among people I know, about their thinking about this war very much.
Kanaan, it's fair to say, is it not, that what you're talking about is an ideal, is the aim, is what could happen. You're not saying this will happen.
No, I'm not. Politics is the art of the possible. I say to you that there is, in the current situation, this possibility. It is not imagined out of blue thin air. It is a doable proposition. And many of the key ingredients for it are there. Others are not. Which will win out in the end? I don't know. It's a very fluid, changing situation. One important key player is the Iraqi opposition. Another key player at the moment, but in some ways the key player of all, is the United States. The United States itself is divided. If the Iraqi opposition is divided, by the way, it's not. It's quite nothing like how divided the American government is. I've been there. I've seen it. There are philosophically deeply different views over what the aftermath of this war, and those incidentally very quickly fracture the Iraqi opposition. One of the reasons, a key reason for the disarray of the Iraqi groups recently over this conference, although I told you that was healing, that's why I'm here. Mm-hmm. A key reason is that they're being pulled by different sections of the American administration. The CIA has its favorite people, the State Department does on the other hand, and the Pentagon and the Vice President's office and so on have different. Everything is pulling it apart. Unfortunately, that is an easily repairable situation. Now, that is a real struggle. I'm not saying it shouldn't be there.
A leap of hope. This is a very large and ungainly dance partner when you start to add together the CIA and the military and the Pentagon and the White House and all those competing interests.
But there are. But I'm not going to sit back and say it's not possible to discuss and to bring it together and to have a view. Of course not. I'm going to fight for what I think is right, and I'm going to argue for this in every possible way. That's why I'm here on The Connection today. And I think it's doable. We're making progress. Look, when I first called back in 1991, I wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times. I said, I finished the war. March onto Baghdad was the title of the piece. I was all out there completely alone. I was hanging like a straw in the wind. All my Arab colleagues and everybody turned against me. Now I wrote a huge, long article in the New York Review of Books about how democracy could be built in Iraq. That was 12 years ago. And it was singing whistling in the air or something back then. But now it's real. There's an important section of opinion inside the United States government that's actually thinking about it. We're discussing with them. So we've made progress.
Connection listeners, we're talking about what would happen in an Iraq after Saddam Hussein, whether or not the United States government has the will, the stick-to-itiveness to follow a plan that is being outlined by, among others, Kanan Makiya. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Join us. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. My guest this hour is Kanan Makiya. He's a professor at Brandeis University, director of the Iraq Research and Documentation Project at Harvard University, and at this particular moment, though, consumed with his work as one of the coordinators of the State Department's Future of Iraq project. For the past 3 months, working with other Iraqi dissidents to pull together a plan for democracy in a post-Saddam Hussein Iraq. Recent news reports indicate that plans for a meeting of Iraqi opposition groups slated for Brussels on the 22nd of November is, looking a little bit sketchy. Some people saying we don't want to show up. Other people saying we will. Other people saying why don't the other people get invited? And around, Kanan Makiya is saying this can be repaired and it will be key to figuring out what happens in Iraq after the war. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Boston. Deborah's on the line. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if Mr. Makiya could comment on how democracy can be established when there's going to be inevitable destruction of, say, the public health infrastructure. I mean, we saw after the Gulf War there was excess mortality from lack of clean drinking water and things like that. So how can that be overcome, and how can either the United States or the Iraqi government ensure that there's going to be, equitable resources for everyone?
My understanding is that the that issue of the destruction of the infrastructure has been taken very carefully into account this time around. And that strategy, which was followed back in 1991, is not what's going to be followed this time. The destruction of the infrastructure was very terrible in the long run. It caused a lot of suffering. And I think the United States is not going to go that route. Incidentally, the kind of weaponry that's possible, the kind of target precision-type bombing is so far advanced from what it was back then that apparently they are sure that they don't need it. I'm not an expert in these questions, but that's one answer. The other, as to how the whole thing will be reconstructed, that what will help enormously is that this time around, thank God, it's about removing the regime. So there's going to be an immediate, and this is definitely part of the military planning for this, an immediate assistant in rebuilding whatever networks do get destroyed and making sure health and food reaches all parts of the population. The American army, I gather, is going to be playing a major role in that. And let's not forget, we have a very developed civil service in Iraq with long experience in these things. It's not it's not Afghanistan. Again, this is, there are, tens of thousands of people in the Ministry of Health and in all the various little hundreds of thousands, if you count all the people down in the provinces and so on, who will be immediately mobilized to fix any damage that occurs. So I think this time around it's going to be insignificant compared to the last.
It does say to me, though, Deborah, that in this case there's going to be a tremendous amount of pressure on the U.S. military and the United States itself to be there with the medicine, with the support for infrastructure in ways that perhaps we've not seen before.
Well, as you were speaking about before, we need this long commitment. I think especially from the United States, we have this pattern of sort of going in and then not really cleaning up. And it will take a long commitment for us to be sure that we actually are providing what we need to provide. So, if indiscriminate bombing does occur and, say, the entire health system is wiped out and, women can't seek care and things like that, it's just...
Deborah,
we need this long-term commitment.
And the way it works, Deborah, is for American citizens to hold their politicians to that. And
yes.
It's American citizens who are easily distracted away from Bosnia
Absolutely.
And Afghanistan, right?
Yes. So
a little bit of pressure on people here, Kanan, no?
Definitely, absolutely. Thanks for that, Dick. I fully agree with that. Deborah, keep up the good work.
1-800-423-8255 to Boston, and Ali's on the line. Hi, Ali.
Good morning, sir. Thank you for having me.
Yes, go ahead.
I just wanted to add, I'm an Iranian and a true believer of the idea that your guest is bringing up. I actually, in support to your well-informed and well-spoken guest, I'd like to add that there are talks within the Iranian community that an intervention of the U.S. in Iraq is also beneficial for Iran as well. And I wonder if your guest has, whether there are any talks within the U.S. government within this matter also.
Well, Kanan, it is pebbles in a pond. That's partly what you're talking about here, that the rebels are supposed to spread. I don't know if that's on your brief, but...
It's not really, but let me say that a successful nation-building democratic experiment in Iraq is going to enormously strengthen the reformers and the Democrats in Iran, who are, by the way, internally much stronger inside Iran than they are inside Iraq at the moment, and who obviously are outside in large numbers as well. So I think there's going to be nothing but positive feedback into the Iranian situation, and hopefully the hardliners will be marginalized over a period of time. There will be even stronger ripple effects, I would suspect, in neighboring countries like Syria, also a Ba'ath regime. Human rights groups that exist in nascent, incipient form will be much bolder. Palestinian reformism, I suspect, will be greatly emboldened by the fact that they have an Arab state that is prepared to back them and support them. So there is going to be a cultural, if I might call it, a political cultural shift of seismic proportions here. It won't happen all at once. It'll happen slowly. But the rhetoric, I think, the culture of rejectionism, of constantly, of ideological politics and so on that is so dominant, and unfortunately said that has come back to the Arab world as a consequence of the Second Intifada, that I hope will be, you know, if this is done right.
If we follow, though, the point that Ali brought to the table, though, you know as well as I do that there is another view in this country, that the neoconservative notion that stirring things up in Iraq, seeing what comes to the surface and hoping that that makes things better for Iran and Turkey and Syria and Saudi Arabia, there's a lot of variables to that, that there's a lot based on faith and hope and chance.
I think a democratic, there's very little doubt that a democratic experience in Iraq, or the beginnings of a transition to democracy in Iraq, which is what we're talking about really here, is going to have a very powerful effect. I don't see, I mean, throughout the region, Saudi Arabia, for one thing, will be weakened, structurally weakened. I personally happen to think that's a good thing. The power that it has exerted through oil revenues, the insidious revolution that it essentially launched that has defaced Islam since the 1973 oil price rises, and that has led to the spread of Wahhabism and the kind of culture of this ascetic Puritan culture that has turned into this nihilistic version in Al-Qaeda. This will be confronted with another serious rival. Iraq has oil reserves equal, some say, to Saudi Arabia itself, untapped as of yet. The potential of deploying this for a complete transformation, even within Islam itself, is very real.
But Ali, from your perspective, when you look at what the Iranian reaction would be, is there not, though, a possibility that a particularly emboldened, Americanized, democratic Iraq might strengthen the hand of the clerics in Tehran?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Because the hands of clerics is very marginalized within the country. The only problem is because...
I'm watching the student demonstrations there and wondering whether or not that's in fact the case. I mean, it's an interesting moment in Iran, isn't it?
Well, it is. You're absolutely right. But you also have to keep in mind that just like Iraq, the Iranian regime is very suppressive. So you see a lot of people such as myself and lots of other people just leave the country, and they just say, you know, we can't take it. And very few that remained actually have been able to take control of the, to an extent, the government, the elected government of Iran. And the unelected are very, very few. And I truly believe that once the democracy comes up in Iran and Iraq, because I believe Iran is the gateway to the Islamic democracy that we've been hearing, and Iraq is a gateway to the Arab nations within the Middle East region, it's going to be a very different world in that area.
Ali, thanks for your call. 1-800-423-8255 to Pawtucket, Rhode Island, and Albert's with us. Hi, Albert.
Hello. I have a question for Professor Makia, but first I would like very briefly to congratulate him on his wonderful books that he has written thus far. I particularly loved The Rock, which is a magnificent work.
I didn't mention that one. You're right. The Republic of Fear, then The Rock, then Cruelty and Silence. Thanks for that, Albert.
And I would like to ask him what sort of evidence he thinks he has that the public opinion situation in Iraq is so markedly different from that of the rest of the Arab world, which has as its linchpin a very strong Islamic anti-Westernism for public opinion in so many facets of life, among the students, among the religious, even among the secularists. This type of anti-Western Islamism seems to be so strong elsewhere. Why do you think that it is different in Iraq?
Well, first, thank you for those kind words. I think it's different. Firstly, I have anecdotal evidence over the summer months from, let's say, friends and close people who came out of Iraq for the summer, either into Jordan, and some of them even made it to London, whom I managed to talk to at length. I'm not alone. There's that anecdotal evidence is everywhere. I have people coming out of Iraq, coming out saying things like, giving me advice to pass on to the Americans. You know, you've got to tell them this. This is the way to do it. Not that the way to do it. And the gist of it is, hurry up, don't delay. Do it. You start here. You know, people, Ba'athist officials are already packing up and selling and so on. Also, there's evidence from organized groups that have people work networks inside, and the Iraqi National Congress has many, many networks throughout Iraq. The stream of defectors tell us what's going on. I mean, we have Ba'athist officials now already buying apartments for themselves, sort of safe houses in Cairo, in Beirut, and elsewhere, preparing the ground for their departure. We have even Ba'athist officials, through networks of contact, saying to people, tell them to hurry up.
Well, is this based on principle or opportunism, recognizing that Saddam may not be around much longer? Could see it both ways, right?
You could see it both ways. But I mean, the point is that the be-all and end-all of Iraqis' worldview is the getting rid of this regime. It is not they see in the world, as they look around the world, they see that the whole Arab world is against them. There is a deep divide between Iraqis and every other Arab at the moment. This, by the way, divide's not new. Mm-hmm. It was true in 1991. My book, which you mentioned, Cruelty and Silence, was about that divide. There's cruelty, which was stories coming out of Iraq and out of places that Iraq had occupied, like Kuwait, and there was silence, which was the language of the Arab intelligentsia that covered up over that cruelty. That divide opened up. I just simply said the emperor has no clothes, and I announced it in that book. But it was real, and every Iraqi found it, experienced it one way or another. Now it's resurfacing with a vengeance, I might add. And several commentators in Al Hayat have the Arabic daily that comes out of London, the most well-read and the best paper around, have commented on this huge chasm that separates Iraqi perceptions of all of this and every other Arab and Muslim, huge tracts of that Arab and Muslim world.
Albert, I hope that that answers your question. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Kana Makia, you left Iraq some, 35 years ago, if my math is right. And you're looking at a horizon now in weeks, not years, of the sort of change that you've hoped for a lot of those 35 years. Do you wake up these mornings thinking the moment might actually happen? Are you hopeful?
Yes. Well, put it this way. I am driven by the possibility, which I understand in a sort of theoretical and abstract way, that it is a possibility only, and perhaps even a less than equal chance. But that it's a triumph of hope over experience, if you might call it that. And it drives me because that's what politics ought to be about. I mean, what actually sickens me a little bit is many of my colleagues who've become tired and cynical. And there was a time when they held hopes and they could fight for ideas. And now they can just sit and criticize and be cynical. It's so easy to do. I mean, it's so easy to do in a situation like this. But it's also so irresponsible.
And would you go back to a democratic Iraq?
Absolutely.
It would be home again.
I would certainly try to see what it means. I can't, who knows, I would enter into it with heart and soul and see what happens.
They might need some architects. I can tell you some of the stuff that Saddam Hussein has put up ain't too pretty.
That's absolutely true.
Kanan Makia, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Professor Makia is at Brandeis University, director of the Iraq Research and Documentation Project at Harvard. But as he mentioned, he's on leave, currently part of the State Department's Future of Iraq project, crafting a blueprint for democracy in post-Saddam Hussein Iraq. Connection listeners, please feel free to continue this conversation. You can find us at our website. We're at theconnection.org. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Arik Karitsky-Fox, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Our interns are Carter Holleran and Meredith Levinson. Our senior producer is Graham Smith. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.
Support for National Public Radio comes from this and other NPR stations. Contributors also include Rockefeller Brothers Fund, providing support for NPR cultural programming through a Charles E. Culpepper Endowment Grant. The W. Alton Jones Foundation, for coverage of efforts to reduce threats of nuclear war and proliferation. www.wajones.org. And the Annie E. Casey Foundation, supporting families and neighborhoods by funding initiatives aimed at helping disadvantaged children. This is NPR, National Public Radio.